and know we're inclining towards a particular emotion before that emotion actually appears. So we can know what's going to we can know something is going to happen before it happens. And I think a few weeks ago I told a story about a time when I was cutting an apple, and the apple brought up a memory of my ex-boyfriend, who I was very angry with at the time. And I could see in that moment that thought arose, that there was an inclination towards anger. The anger had not arisen, but I could see the mind kind of wanting to jump onto that thought and become angry. There was this movement of, yeah, I want to get angry about this. And seeing that intention or that movement of mind towards anger allowed me to let go of it. I mean, I didn't even actually have to let go of it. It let go of itself, because by that point, this is the same anger I described a few minutes ago, where I was waking up for the anger in my day as it came up. So I had been spending a long time, several weeks, maybe even a couple of months, really feeling what it felt like to be angry in the body and seeing just how incredibly unpleasant it was and how painful and how much suffering I was in because I was angry. And when the mind saw the inclination to anger, it's like, I know where that's going. That's going into suffering. I'm not going there. And it was like letting go of a hot pot. You know, the body does that automatically because it's suffering. And it was the same thing. The mind let go of that inclination to anger because it knew it was suffering. So you can actually see the inclination towards things, and that seeing can help to free us. So in and of itself, intention is a neutral event. It's simply an energetic impulse that's felt sometimes it's felt in the body, sometimes it's felt as a thought or a leaning in the mind. It's the sense of knowing something is about to happen before it happens. Some teachers actually call it the about to moment. We know something is about to happen. But accompanying that about to moment is there's always, almost always a reason for that movement of mind or body or speech. There's a motivation that comes with the intention. So in the place of knowing what's going to happen before it happens, we have an opportunity to see what our motivation is for taking that action. Are we motivated out of compassion? Are we motivated out of greed or anger? Or maybe simply out of a need, a physical need. I'm hungry, I need to eat. There are many possible reasons why we might do something. There are many possible motivations. One of the most powerful places to practice this is in the area of speech. It's very challenging. Paying attention to speech is very, very challenging practice. At least I have found it to be, and most people I've talked to have found it to be. Much of the time we speak automatically without knowing that we're going to speak or what we're going to say. And much less often do we have any clue about how what we're going to say will impact the person that we're speaking to. So a great exercise to try is to pause before you speak. Just pause. That's it. That's the whole instruction. Don't try to do much of anything except pause. And even that, even remembering to do that can be hard. But if you can do that, if you just remember to pause, what it allows you to do is first, you know, oh, I'm going to say something. So that piece is there. You know that you're going to speak. And you'll probably see kind of automatically what it is you're going to say. You know, you'll know what you're going to say before you say it. And you may also get a chance to see what your motivation for saying it is. So just the pause can open up the ability to see these things. So getting in touch with our motivation for why we say what we say can be a very humbling to say the least, practice, we may find a lot of different motivations, wanting to impress, wanting to convey information, wanting to help someone, wanting to refrain from saying something else, wanting to lash out at someone. There can be many, many reasons why we speak. So seeing how often our intentions for speech are less than skillful can be a little bit distressing at times. But this isn't meant to be a practice where you judge yourself for your motivations. It's really simply meant to uncover what's already happening, to recognize what's happening, to not have these things happening in our subconscious. And when you find that you are acting out of a particular motivation and see that that motivation can lead to something that will cause suffering for either yourself or others, you have an opportunity to let go of it. If you see that your motivation is one of compassion, you have the opportunity to appreciate the compassion along with whatever else is happening in the moment. So the present moment is the only place where we can act. It's the only place where we can choose how to respond to what life presents us. The past is gone. It is no more than thoughts in the present moment. So the past is constructed by thoughts in the present moment. The future doesn't exist. The future is no more than thoughts about what might happen, happening in the present moment. So there's really nothing happening except for what's happening in the present moment. And this moment has been brought about by a whole mix of causes and conditions, most of which we don't have much control over. The whole billions of years of the evolution of the universe came together to bring this moment together and didn't have much control over most of that. Didn't have any control over my parents getting together to have me born. I mean, lots of things I had no control over that led up to this very moment. But we do have a choice of how we respond in this moment. It's the only thing we ever have a choice about, is how we respond in this moment. And the Buddha taught that this choice point is the key to our happiness. If we can see this choice point, there's a higher likelihood that we will choose actions and motivations that lead to happiness and lead us away from suffering. So one of the aspects of this teaching that's important to recollect, though, is that while we do have some control over our own choice of how we respond in the present moment, we don't have any control over the results of that choice. We have very little control. I'll put it that way. We have very little control over the results of that choice. We cannot control how people are going to respond to us. We can't control how the universe is going to react to our choice. So we need to let go of specific outcomes for our actions. So if our choice is coming with a particular motivation to have a particular outcome, that itself may lead us into suffering, disappointment, if it doesn't come out that way. But we can take a sort of refuge in knowing that we are responding to the world as skillfully as we can. And that itself can bring a great deal of joy to our practice. Just knowing, yep, I'm really, really trying to be as skillful as I can. Somebody asked the Dalai Lama at one point how he felt when actions that he took led to unfavorable outcomes. And his response was, "My pure intention is my protection." One way to look at our motivation, aside from looking at our speech, is to look at the Buddha's teachings on ethics. or sila is what it's called in Pali. This teaching is really about paying attention to our relationships with others. So for lay people, the Buddha suggested five guidelines or precepts for ethical conduct in the world. And these guidelines are to refrain from killing, to refrain from taking what is not given, to refrain from sexual misconduct, and that in the Buddhist tradition at the time of the Buddha meant marital infidelity, to refrain from lying, and to refrain from intoxication. So these guidelines are taken on as practices, not as a way to judge ourselves for right and wrong, or even to decide whether we are right or wrong, but more to help us look at our motivations, look at our intentions and motivations for why we do what we do. We might consider these five things mindfulness bells, as I was talking about earlier, you know, something to attend to say, I'm going to pay attention if this thing comes up. Most of us don't, I mean, in the Buddhist, in the Pali Canon, the Buddhist teaching about refraining from killing for lay people really was explicitly refraining from killing human beings. But we can also look at our motivation if we're going to kill an ant or going to kill a spider. Can we pick up the spider and put it outside instead? So just to look at our motivation, why are we doing this? Is it a motivation of aversion? Oh, I can't stand spiders. Or what is the motivation? There can be mixed motivations. I mean, the whole issue of malarial mosquitoes, for instance, may be a good reason why we might choose to kill some mosquitoes, to spray an area so that the mosquitoes won't infect the people and have so many people dying. So there are trade-offs at times. But to just look at our motivation, what is our motivation behind this action? So we can look at these five things as mindfulness bells, and when they happen, pay attention, wake up. What's happening? What's my motivation behind this activity? So these five precepts are stated in the negative as actions to avoid. But they each have a positive aspect, that is a positive quality of mind that is cultivated with the action, along with the action that we're avoiding. So each of the precepts is paired with a corresponding positive mental quality. Refraining from killing is paired with compassion. Refraining from taking what is not given is paired with honesty and contentment. Refraining from sexual misconduct or marital infidelity is paired with fidelity. Refraining from lying is paired with truthfulness. And refraining from intoxication is paired with clarity of mind or heedfulness. So as we try to cultivate these actions, the refraining from these actions, we are actually cultivating these positive qualities of mind at the same time. There's a kind of a mutual interconnection between the mind and the body. Making changes to our mind can result in changes to our actions. But likewise, and more important in some ways for the beginning part of a practice, is that making changes to our actions can have a lasting and very deep impact on our minds. We can actually change the way our minds work by changing how we respond to the world. And that point of connection between the mind and the body is that point of intention, that moment of choice. So a question sometimes comes up about why these precepts are stated in the negative as actions to avoid, as opposed to in the positive, like I vow to cultivate compassion or I vow to cultivate truthfulness. And I read a very beautiful response to this question by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is an American monk who has done a lot of sutta translation. He's translated most of the Pali Canon. And he had a wonderful response to this, and I will just read it to you because I thought, I don't think I can restate it any better. So why are the precepts stated into the negative? In the negative as actions to avoid, as opposed to in the positive as qualities to cultivate? The answer to this is twofold. First, in order to develop the positive virtues, we have to begin by abstaining from the negative qualities opposed to them. The growth of the positive virtues will only be stunted or deformed as long as the defilements are allowed to reign unchecked. And the defilements is his term for unskillful mind states. We cannot cultivate compassion while at the same time indulging in killing, or cultivate honesty while stealing and cheating. At the start, we have to abandon the unwholesome through the aspect of avoidance. Only when we have secured a foundation in avoiding the unwholesome can we expect to succeed in cultivating the factors of positive performance. The process of purifying virtue can be compared to growing a flower garden on a plot of uncultivated land. We don't begin by planting the seeds in expectation of a bountiful yield. We have to start with the duller work of weeding out the garden and preparing the beds. Only after we have uprooted the weeds and nourished the soil can we plant the seeds in the confidence that the flowers will grow healthily. Another reason why the precepts are worded in terms of abstinence is that the development of positive virtues cannot be prescribed by rules. Rules of training can govern what we have to avoid and perform in our outer actions, but only ideals of aspiration, not rules, can govern what develops within ourselves. Thus, we cannot take up a training rule to always be loving towards others. To impose such a rule is to place ourselves in a double bind, since inner attitudes are just simply not so docile that they can be determined by command. Love and compassion are the fruits of the work we do on ourselves inwardly, not of assenting to a precept. What we can do is to undertake a precept to abstain from destroying life and from injuring other beings. Then we can make a resolution, preferably without much fanfare, to develop loving kindness and apply ourselves to the mental training designed to nourish its growth. So those are some of my thoughts on working with practice in daily life, and I'd like to open it up to comments or questions, whatever you... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking that I listened to that Carmel tape, and it's kind of hard to meditate after a day of murdering and stealing. That's a nice little mnemonic.
Yeah, that's true. Thank you.
I have one other.
Sure. Oh, that's a great practice.
Or other things, but I mean, really, and if I'm, you know, if I'm not present, he got sick the other day, and it's because I was impatient and rushing, and it forced me to stop. I had to be late for over a half an hour, and just stay with him and tell him I was sorry for half an hour, and he was fine.
Wow, that's great. What a wonderful practice. Great. Has that helped you bring your practice into your day as well?
I have a very difficult time meditating. I mean, even for 5 minutes, properly, you know, I don't know. But I feel like I'm mindful in various activities. And I go to the ranch pretty much every day, and so for sure.
That's like your period of meditation, that
yeah,
period.
Sure.
Yeah, that's great. And sometimes we start there. We start with our daily practice. I did for months. I couldn't imagine myself sitting down to meditate, but this paying attention to the anger was really beneficial. I could tell that. And after a couple months of that, I think it was about 3 months, of paying attention, I finally realized, oh, maybe when I sit down, it'll make it actually so that I get more skillful at being able to pay attention in my daily life. But it took a very long time for me to actually want to sit down to meditate. So, you know, it may come, it may not. But I'm really glad about your opportunity with your horse. Yeah.
Did mindfulness help you to let go of your anger, do you think? Or did you just sort of observe it as it faded away on its own?
Well, it was a couple of year process. But yes, the mindfulness, it allowed me to completely let go of that anger. I think I told the story a little bit a few weeks ago, but I'll just repeat a little bit of it here. So initially the anger was over a boyfriend who had broken up with me. I mean, actually, he had proposed to me, and 6 weeks later he broke up with me. So, you know, I was really angry about this, and so the anger was pretty much directed at him. That was the anger that I was vowing to wake up for, the anger at him. I mean, other anger during my day I didn't worry about so much, but that particular anger was what was completely out of control. It was ruling my life. And as I said, over the course of months, it got easier and easier to wake up for it, so that initially when I woke up for it, I'd be in a full-blown rage. But over the course of several months, I would wake up for it when I was just slightly irritated, as opposed to in a full-blown rage. So it really helped my my sanity and my own being to not get into those full-blown rages. And over the course of years, I just kept bringing my attention. Whenever the anger would come up, I would just bring my attention to the anger. And often, actually, because I saw frequently that I would get pulled in to the story when it happened, I got pretty skillful at letting it go. So I'd notice, yep, I'm angry. Not now. I could tell that, and the not now was about recognizing that the mindfulness wasn't strong enough to meet the anger, that the anger would overwhelm the mindfulness and I would get pulled in and become angry. So that was the motivation for saying not now. It wasn't so much an aversion at the anger. It was, yep, that's anger. I know where that's going. Let me put it aside. And the way I put it aside was to bring my attention to something neutral. It seemed like it often came up when I was walking somewhere. And I would just pay attention to my steps, to the feet on the ground, and just bring my attention to something neutral, away from the anger. And over the course of years, I actually thought I was going to have to pay direct attention to that anger at some point. You know, I'd have to bring my mindfulness to bear on it, practice loving kindness to my ex-boyfriend. You know, I thought I was going to have to really work with this at some point when my mindfulness came up to snuff. But what happened was, just over time, what I began to notice is that the anger started appearing less and less frequently. Just by doing this simple, yep, I'm angry, not now. And then one day, I recognized, wow, it's been a long time since I felt that anger. I wonder what happened to it. And I didn't really trust it, you know. I thought it was actually going to erupt in that moment, because I recognized that I hadn't felt the anger. So the thought of my boyfriend arose in my mind, and I didn't get angry. And I thought, wow, it kind of feels like it's gone. And it was. It has not come back since. And actually, since then, I've really realized a depth of forgiveness for him and feelings of loving kindness for him, really wishing him well. So it definitely, the whole practice, it unfolded over years. I mean, it wasn't something that happened quickly, but it made a huge difference to me. And just those small moments, I mean, just the step from going from full-blown rage to irritation, I could see, oh, this is really helpful, you know, I'm not suffering so much. And it really was an incentive to keep going. So yes.
Is avoidance opposite of mindfulness? Can you say negative behavior?
I would say ignorance is the opposite of mindfulness. I wouldn't say avoidance is. Aversion has a quality of pushing away, of saying, no, I don't like this. But you can actually be mindful of aversion. So they're not actually opposite. The opposite of mindfulness is non-mindfulness, when you're not aware. And that's what ignorance would be. Aversion is typically an unskillful mind state. What I was talking about when I said not now, that the motivation behind that was not aversion. It wasn't so much pushing away the anger as it was saying, I know where this is going, and I can't continue paying attention to this particular thing because I know it will lead me into the anger. So I'm just going to pay attention to something else. And I wasn't trying to push it away particularly. It was more switching the attention. I mean, many, many things are happening at a time. Anger is happening and I'm walking. So the steps are happening. The sensations of steps are happening at the same time the anger is happening. So if you can just switch your attention to something else, that kind of just ignoring, it's almost saying, no, not now, you know, just bring your attention to something else. The mindfulness can be there on something else, and you can ignore something that's difficult. Does that answer your question?
I find it hard to ignore.
Find it hard to ignore? Things like the like anger, for instance?
Yeah, whatever, the negative
emotion. Yeah, well, you know, that's the way, I mean, that's why I said that it happened over a long time, that initially I couldn't ignore the anger because it just kind of built up, and I got into a full-blown rage, and at that point my task was to pay attention to what it feels like to be in a full-blown rage, and that is really unpleasant. And over time, the mind realizes, yes, that if I pay attention to this thing, or if I let myself get caught in this anger, that's where it's headed. It's headed to that really, really unpleasant suffering state. And the mind begins to let go of it. It's not something you have to do. So if you find it difficult to let go of something, just pay attention to what it is you find it difficult to put aside. And over time, it may instruct you. It may begin to let go of itself.
So I guess I'm being impatient. It would take a while.
Potentially. It does. It can take a long time. And that's why I like to tell the story about this anger unfolding over years, because it took a very long time, but it did go away completely. So there is hope. Yeah.
I found the fifth precept, avoid intoxication, to be odd, because it surprised me. I guess I wondered, do they mean alcohol, or what sort of intoxication? Then I also related it to myself, because I have trouble with alcohol, and particularly since some really upsetting family things happened, you know, starting January for a number of months. So I can't control myself, and I'm thinking, well, so there's avoidance of intoxication, and then there's trying to seek clarity of mind. And when you said that, I thought, but I don't want awareness, which is why I do the alcohol. I don't want mindfulness, so I guess could you talk about that, and why is that precept? Was there a lot of intoxication in Buddhist time? And why was that included?
Well, I think that it's included. I mean, it is referring primarily to alcohol and drugs, and probably primarily alcohol, although there were probably drugs in the Buddhist time. I'm not sure what they would be, but, you know, plants or whatever. But it is primarily referring to the intoxication that comes from ingesting something for the purpose of intoxication. So, you know, recreational drugs or alcohol in our time. And there are some contention, I would say, or debate among people about whether it means to avoid taking the substances that lead to intoxication, or just to avoid taking them to the point of intoxication. So, for instance, you can have a few sips of wine, maybe a half a glass of wine, without getting intoxicated. So is that okay? There are different, people fall down in different camps. And so I just decided to talk about the intoxication piece being the result of the actual clouding of the mind through alcohol or drugs. So the reason it's discussed is because the alcohol clouds the mind. It makes it very difficult to be mindful. And it also leads to heedlessness often. The intoxication leads to actions that we, it may lead to breaking the other precepts, essentially, to actions where we end up lying to people or harming people or stealing things. So the reason for it is because it clouds the mind. So it's precisely why you want to do it, essentially. I don't want to pay attention. That's why I want to get intoxicated, so I don't have to pay attention. But it's precisely the reason why he suggests it as a precept, because it does cloud the mind, and it makes it very difficult to pay attention. I, at one point, began to realize that if I even had a glass of wine at night before I went to bed, that the next morning my mind was still cloudy, and it was hard to meditate the next morning. And as I began to see that, it was like, well, I've got a choice. You know, I can have an enjoyable glass of wine in the evening and then blow off the next morning of meditation, or I can let go of the glass of wine in the evening and cultivate the clarity of mind. And at that point, for me, cultivating clarity of mind was really helpful. And so that was my vow. I actually completely eliminated alcohol from my diet. So I found it very helpful for cultivating clarity of mind. Was there another piece of your question that I haven't addressed yet?
Well, I was wondering if there was something going on at Buddhist in that particular time in the world that it was a problem that people were doing that a lot.
Well, I think it's pretty much a problem at all times. I don't think there's been a time in the world that alcohol has not been a problem. I don't know if there are any particular, there might be some particular stories about monks getting intoxicated or lay people getting intoxicated and what it leads to. But it's definitely, I mean, it's a problem now, and I think it's just as long as there have been people distilling and fermenting grains and fruits, it's been a problem. That's true. That's a nice.
You can get lost in that.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, I think it was amazing.
That's beautiful.
Pieces every step. And I've given it to people who are actually dying, but I've given it to all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I don't know, the real gem.
Did everybody hear that? Peace in it. Peace in every step.
Peace
is every step. And what she said was that she found that anytime somebody gave her the book and said, anytime that you're struggling, open the book to any page and read it. It's usually a very short section. And she said she found that over time, you know, that it really spoke to her, that it as she opened it when she was struggling, that it really helped to transform what was happening for her. And that she used it for years and carried it with her everywhere to open it when she needed it. And now she actually hasn't had to use it for a while, but it was very helpful, so she wanted to share it with people. And that's beautiful. Thank you. That can be anything that helps us is so valuable, and sharing those things, that's great. Thank you. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, I remember Gil saying in this past winter, he either said that Buddhism, or he might have said that meditation practice is the antidote. Can you see this as an antidote to all addiction?
So she said that Gil has said that meditation is the antidote to addiction. And it's definitely true that addiction has that kind of wanting quality. Go ahead.
Yeah, or he might have also said Buddhist psychology. I wasn't sure if he said mindfulness. Yeah, and it just kind of occurred to me because it's like the opposite.
Yeah, it is. And it can be really hard. When our whole movement of mind is to say, no, don't want to be there, to make that step to say, I'm going to try to be there for it. And that step is, it takes courage. So, did you have? No. Okay.
I just had a question for you, more curiosity than anything else. But so everybody in this room has theoretically been doing this for at least 5 weeks now. Do you see any difference in the people sitting in front of you now than from what you saw 5 weeks ago?
You know, I think very small, maybe. I mean, the room feels like it gets pretty still in that first meditation, which is really lovely. It really feels like it just settles. But, you know, I haven't been looking at individuals or anything to judge or, you know. How's that person doing? But as a whole, it feels like the room settles. Really, really lovely settling in that meditation. So we could end with the settling. We could end with, we've got about 7 minutes, so let's end with the sitting. So let yourself relax around the alertness of your spine. And take a few deep breaths. Letting go of the busy activity of the mind. And let the breath return to normal. And bring your attention to the gentle sensations of breathing. Let yourself rest with the rhythm of breathing in and breathing out. So this is the last evening of our introductory class, and thank you all for coming and participating. It's been such a wonderful experience here with you, so I really enjoyed it.